Mr. Willis.
May it please the Court, Jerry Willis on behalf of Appellant Eastland Music Group, LLC. Throughout the argument, I may refer to the plaintiff appellant as Eastland, or EMG for short, and I will refer to the three defendants as defendants if that's okay. We are here before this Court to appeal the decision of the United States District Court entered on July 19, 2012, wherein the District Court granted the defendant's motion to dismiss EMG's claim for trademark infringement against defendants for defendants' unauthorized use of EMG's 50-50 trademark as the title of their film. The District Court's decision is subject to de novo review by this Court.
How specifically will the film's title cause confusion? That is, cause someone to think that the title denotes a relationship between Eastland and the film's authorship, sponsorship, or content?
First, I would say that at this stage of the pleading, we're not there. Those are obviously things that we would have to prove if we were given the opportunity to take discovery and develop evidence. But the simple answer to the question is to have people, consumers, who would believe that Eastland, who is in the business of providing entertainment, music videos, and the sort, would have had something to do with the making of this movie, which bears the same the name of the movie bears the same name as Eastland's trademark that it's been using for in excess of a decade.
But, I mean, isn't 50-50 just a common figure of speech? You know, it's used to reference an even chance of something occurring. Would Eastland's trademark prohibit other uses of the term 50-50? For instance, what if the movie Chances Are was called Chances Are 50-50, or A Lady Takes a Chance, or A Lady Takes a 50-50 Chance? Would those be prohibited?
It would depend on the facts of the case. And again, I think that that would be through evidence that we would gather through the course of discovery, including things like taking surveys to determine whether or not consumers would believe that titles such as Your Honor just used would be confusing to our target audience.
I counted 53 movies before I stopped with the word chance in them on Netflix, including five different movies with the title Second Chance or The Second Chance or Second Chances, nine DVDs with some form of taking a chance. I was singing it to myself, taking a chance on love, indicating that Lionsgate may have faced even bigger risks if it had expressed its theme with the word chance. So how is it that five movies can have the title Second Chance without violating the Lanham Act?
I would say that it depends, again, on the facts and circumstances and whether and what words were used before or after the second chance.
No, that's Second Chance.
I thought you said Second Chance was in the title, not Second Chance is the title.
Yeah, but the Second Chance or Second Chance. I mean, surely you're not saying that to add the word the.
No, I'm sorry, Your Honor, I misunderstood. I thought Second Chance was part of a longer title. I would say in that case it depends, again, on whether anyone has a registered trademark to that and what the trademark means to that individual company and what people associate that mark with.
Well, what discovery would you take if you could, very specifically?
I think we would request documents to from the defendants to determine how they came up with the title. We would take depositions.
No, the request was to be specific, not to say our plan is to go on a fishing expedition. Be specific.
We would take depositions and try to see if we could get admissions from the individuals that were involved in developing the movie.
Specific. What individual are you searching for in discovery?
Well, for example, in the Rosa Parks case, when she took discovery.
You're not asking about the Rosa Parks case. We're asking about this case.
That's the type of specific evidence, Your Honor. In that case, she was able to obtain admissions from the individuals who wrote the song that the song wasn't really about Rosa Parks.
In other words, you are going on a fishing expedition and hope that something turns up.
I believe that in the vast majority, discovery, when you start discovery, it is that. We would direct our discovery to be specific to the things that we would like to obtain, such as, are there admissions? The other opportunity through discovery would be our own developing of evidence through conducting surveys of our own.
You don't need discovery to conduct surveys of your own. In fact, the non-existence of these surveys before you filed your suit raises questions under Rule 11. I mean, your answer to Judge Rovner's question suggests, well, we don't actually have any evidence of confusion, but we're suing anyway.
Well, what we do have...
Rule 11 requires you to have evidence before you make allegations.
And what we do have is we own the registered trademark 50-50. We have common law trademark rights in the mark 50-50. And we know that the defendants have used the mark without permission or license from EMG, who owns the trademark. We have alleged in our complaint that there is likelihood of confusion, and we believe that the evidence will show that.
By the way, by your claim that you have a common law trademark in 50/50, have you looked at the Internet Movie Database to see how many movies have the title 50/50?
I have not.
The answer is at least five have the precise title 50/50 using numerals. Three of those five predate your claim. So if there is an infringement here, it looks like you're the infringer.
Well, unless those parties have abandoned that mark.
They haven't abandoned the mark. Those movies are for sale. Type in 50/50 in Amazon. See if you can get the DVDs.
Well, the fact of the matter is we have been using that mark, 50/50 or 50-50 or 50/50 next to each other, in the marketplace for 10 years. And we believe that we do have a common law right in that mark. If there is evidence out there that suggests otherwise, I would say that that would come up in defendant's defense during the ordinary course of the case. But again, in this case...
You don't need discovery or the ordinary course of the case to look in the Internet Movie Database to see whether DVDs of movies called 50/50 are readily available for commercial sale. It's not real hard.
But I believe, Your Honor, that still doesn't change the fact that we have a registered mark in the name 50/50 that's nationwide in effect. I don't know if these other people have registered trademarks or not.
You do not have a registered trademark in the symbols 50/50.
That is correct.
The registered mark is in the homophone of 50/50.
That is correct.
And, of course, the movie didn't use the homophone. The movie didn't use the registered mark.
That is correct. So with respect to moving on with respect to the law, this circuit has held that in instances where a motion to dismiss is based on an affirmative defense, the standards are even more stringent upon the moving party. This court has held that only when the plaintiff pleads itself out of court.
Let me try a different version of Judge Rovner's question. What is your best reason for thinking that anybody buying the movie, a DVD of the movie 50/50, of the most recent movie 50/50, would believe that it comes from Eastland Music Group? That's the trademark question, whether there's a confusion about a designation of origin. But what's your best reason to think that that would be a problem?
Because EMG's consumers and people who are familiar with the brand 50/50, including the production company, the videos, the entertainment that they provide, has become well known among their group of consumers. And if somebody in their target group were to go to a store and see the title 50/50 on a film package.
No, you're not giving any reason. I'm asking for a reason, and you're saying, well, people might think this way. Have people called up Eastland Enterprises and said, please send us a copy of the DVD of 50/50?
Not that I'm aware of, Your Honor.
Is there any reason to think that there is more potential for confusion here than there was in Daystar against 20th Century Fox?
I'm not sure if I'm familiar with that case.
A claim very like the claim you're making went to the Supreme Court of the United States 9 years ago. That's the Daystar case. I am more than a little surprised that nobody has been citing or discussing Daystar. And Daystar made it perfectly plain that reusing titles from earlier intellectual property work does not create a trademark problem unless there's very powerful evidence of confusion about origin. And I don't see how you could get to, you know, you can't even get out of the batter's box, let alone to first base, without coping with Daystar. And yet you tell me you don't know the controlling Supreme Court precedent.
I'm not familiar with the Daystar case, Your Honor.
Mm.
I see that my time is...
Thank you, Mr. Willis. Mr. Ferber.
Good morning. May it please the Court, I'm Tom Ferber of Prior Cashman LLP. We represent the defendants, appellees. It's, of course, not disputed that we're dealing here with a work of artistic expression, which the Supreme Court on multiple occasions and this Court have said enjoyed the protections of the First Amendment. And this case appears in a landscape of decisions...
That's what the First Amendment has to do with this. First, we don't start any case with a constitutional issue. You get to a constitutional issue only if somebody says here that the Lanham Act is unconstitutional. And I'm not, I don't for a second think there's any constitutional problem in the Lanham Act. We first have to figure out whether there's a plausible claim, but we never start with the Constitution.
Your Honor, that is absolutely true. In the context of this case, the reason it came up was because in order to move at the inception of the case and not become involved in what we thought would be months of wasteful and expensive discovery regarding surveys and depositions and paperwork, we thought it was clear under the case law that existed in other circuits that there was not a plausible prima facie case on the face of the pleading once the film was looked at. The title was looked at in context of the film's content.
When your client made the film 50-50, did you either negotiate for the rights to that from the producers of the 50-50 films in 1916, 1925, 1981, 1982, 1992, and oh, by the way, there's one made in Russian in 1972. I mean, that's what the Internet Movie Database tells me. You negotiate with any of those people?
Your Honor, to the best of my knowledge, that didn't even come up.
Any of those people make a trademark claim against you?
Nobody else has.
Those people actually made movies with 50-50 and not P-H-I-F-T-Y.
Yes. Your Honor, if I can focus, actually, if you want to avoid the broader constitutional question, many courts, even in the pre-Rogers landscape, including, by the way, the district court in Rogers, and the First Circuit in the Alabine case said, look, when you're talking about an alleged infringement under the Lanham Act, you're talking about goods and services. And many courts have said, that means commercial goods and services. It's not meant to extend to something like the title of a song or a book or a film.
Well, the Supreme Court said in Daystar that it could if there was pretty good reason to think that it would produce confusion about origin. That's why Judge Rogner and I were asking Mr. Willis, do you have any reason to think there's confusion of origin?
I don't think there is any reason to think there's confusion here. I didn't fully appreciate the reference to Daystar because I always think of Daystar as a plaintiff who had, well, in that case it happened to be an expired copyright, but a plaintiff who was trying to use the Lanham Act kind of as a backdoor way to make a copyright claim.
Use the Lanham Act to extend copyright, but of course the critical holding in Daystar is about the scope of the Lanham Act.
Yes, it's about and talking about what origin means in the context of Section 43A. But that was really a reverse passing off claim, which is why it didn't occur to me here that that would be the controlling precedent. I think, frankly, of the limitations of goods and services in the Lanham Act and what that means, and I think of the case law that's come down from other circuits, which, as I said, the reason we rest on those in making our motions, you didn't have to get into how was the title arrived at, were there negotiations, what was your intent. All that's irrelevant. The Lanham Act, in one respect, at least to state a prima facie case, becomes almost a strict liability statute. Whether you intended to confuse or not doesn't matter. It's the question is it there anything in that title that is overtly or explicitly misleading? The answer clearly is no. As the courts in Rogers and Mattel pointed out, in our modern society, people don't look to the titles of artistic expressive works to be the source denoters. Any more than, for instance, to give you some ideas from films that of recent origin. You don't look to Midnight in Paris. You don't look to Lincoln. You don't look to Trouble with the Curve to try and decide or determine what the source is. If you want to know who the filmmaker is, well, you'd look to see it was Spielberg or Clint Eastwood or Woody Allen. And if you care about who the studio is behind it, you look to see the names and the logos of, let's say, a Warner Brothers or a Universal or an MGM. In this case, you can't. When you watch the movie, in big, bold letters and logos, you see at the very beginning the names of Mandate and Summit. If you buy it, if you don't care to read what's on the back of the packaging of the DVD, where you see those names and logos, it's certainly on the DVD itself as soon as you take it out of the package. And again, as soon as you put in your DVD player, you're going to see who the source is, that it's Mandate and Summit. So the way that titles of films work in our society simply doesn't suggest there would be any confusion here. And with it, as I said, although this circuit hasn't addressed it, some district courts within the circuit have addressed the test, and the Woodard v. Jackson, no, excuse me, this was the Dillinger case, said, look, the plaintiff hasn't even tried to identify something here that was explicitly misleading. That alone should be dispositive of the second prong of that test. We submit that that's true here. And with respect to the first prong, the artistic relevance, we think it's clear. Because as the district judge correctly said, in the first 12 minutes, you see that the protagonist has been given a 50-50 chance of surviving his diagnosis of spinal cancer, and he and his friend have a discussion about, okay, we're going to beat the 50-50 odds. No more relevance should be required, and we think it's plenty of relevance, but even the plaintiff has admitted there is at least minimal relevance. They just think that it should be, you should get an A on relevance rather than a B minus. We don't think that this test is about letter grades. We think it's a pass-fail test, and this is a clear pass. Judges don't want to become involved in judging literary merits any more than, for instance, they'd want to try and figure out whether Hemingway really needed to call his famous novel A Farewell to Arms. Is that the most relevant title? It's just not what judges want to do. This title was more than sufficiently relevant. There's nothing explicitly misleading. And our society does not look to titles of films to determine what the source of the film is. If there are no further questions, that's all I have. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. Anything further, Mr. Willis?
Further, Your Honor.
I would just like to quickly address the Sixth Circuit's decision in Rosa Parks with respect to the Rogers-Grimaldi test that counsel just talked about. And in that case, the district court made the same finding that counsel is arguing for here, that the relevance of the subject matter with the title of the work is obvious. In fact, the district court said it was not even open to reasonable debate. However, the Sixth Circuit disagreed. The Sixth Circuit said it believed that the relevance of the subject matter with the title was open to reasonable debate, and in fact said that not only is it open to reasonable debate, that it's a question of fact that needs to be determined by a trier of fact upon evidentiary hearing. And then lastly, I'd like to point out that in all of the cases relied upon by defendants, Rogers versus Grimaldi, Mattel versus MCA, Revolution versus Perez, Rosa Parks versus LaFace, Roxbury versus Penthouse, and I should correct, all the circuit court cases relied upon by the defendants, the plaintiffs were all entitled in those cases to take discovery, to develop evidence, and to build their case, as well as to rebut the defendants' First Amendment defenses. Thank you.
Oh, before you sit down, do you think Truman Capote has a problem with the title Breakfast at Tiffany's?
I would not know, Your Honor.
Isn't that blatantly trademark infringement? And, of course, the movie would also be trademark infringement.
Again, I would have to... That's why these cases are typically taken on a case-by-case basis. Because it's...
There are governing rules of law. All right. Thank you very much, counsel. The case is taken under advisement. Our final case of the day is Wang against...